Newtown Radioactive, July 5th, 2005. Well, folks, welcome to Newtown Radioactive for July 5th, 2005. I, as always, am Ken Newquist, your host. And if I sound kind of mellow and a little down today, it's because I'm really freaking tired. My daughter decided that, well, 3 o'clock in the morning is a really good time to get up and color. So last night she started crying, and I wake up, and Sue goes in and checks on her and brings her in, and I could just tell from that vibe that Sue was giving off that she just was not up for dealing with Jordan that night. So I decided, okay, well, you know what? Jordan is clearly not going to go to sleep. For those of you who are new to the podcast, Jordan is two. So I thought, okay, I'll take her upstairs. So I take her up to the third floor, and I thought I might be able to just play with her for a bit, and then, or she could just hang out and, you know, sit on my lap as we play video games, which is our normal thing to do if she wakes up at this time, and she might go back to sleep after, say, half an hour. But she didn't. No, she was up till 6, at which point I finally gave up and said I need to get more than 3 hours sleep, and went down, got up Sue, went back to sleep for like an hour or hour and a half before I got up to go to work. Which, you know, it's just it's just exhausting, guys. And it gets me to think, I saw a post, I think it was on joystick.com, that was asking the question, well, does late-night gaming prepare you for parenthood? Basically, the idea being that, you know, you can kind of build up a tolerance, you're used to staying up at all hours, therefore, when you have a kid, you're ready for it, you're prepared. My response to that proposal is that in so much as it helps you build up a tolerance, late night gaming, and we've all done it. I mean, I stayed up playing Baldur's Gate until the little birds chirping turned out not to be the game, but the actual birds outside waking up because the sun was coming up. You know, late night gaming, it can prepare you in terms of sleep deprivation and having to get up and go to work the next day. But the difference between having a kid and sleep deprivation and gaming and sleep deprivation is that you don't get a choice to do it when it's your kid. You may be really, really freaking tired, but, you know, you don't have a choice to kind of say, oh, you know what, I'm not going to get up and deal with the kid tonight. You have to get up and deal with the kid tonight. You know, you can't quit and save the game and come back to it later. It's real life. Now, having said that, games do help you, I think, as a geek mom or dad, because it gives you something to do when the kid is up at 3 a.m. and crying. I know I spent, when Jordan was a baby, I spent more than a few nights playing Warcraft 3 with her. And continuing that tradition, earlier this week, I finally gave in and bought World of Warcraft, which a lot of my friends are playing, and which, after juggling some accounts around and moving Nuketown to a new domain, I suddenly had an extra $30 a month, so I thought, hey, I now can honestly go out and get this game without on a clear conscience, we should say. Because, you know, it's a $15 a month charge, which is not insignificant. So last night, as Jordan was sitting on my lap, I was playing World of Warcraft, which, you know, it brought back some fond memories of being up with her when she was a wee child and, you know, drinking her milk. I really wish I could have just slept, but, you know, if you got to be awake, playing World of Warcraft with your daughter isn't necessarily a bad thing. Jordan has some mixed feelings on the game. Doesn't really like the wolf spiders that come charging out at you. Also, she not too hip on the wolves, but she really likes the deer, and the bunnies are pretty darn cute. So, net-net, I think she's liking World of Warcraft. I should note, if you folks want to look me up online, and I'll have this in the show notes, but I'm playing on the Thunderhorn server, and right now I'm playing a mage named Zalandarin, which was named in honor of a dearly departed PC that I played during our Return to the Temple of Elemental Evil campaign. He got killed by some of the Elementalists and sacrificed to Therizdin, so he wasn't coming back in the D&D game, but hey, you know what? New setting, new online game, I can bring Zil back, man. So if you happen to be on WoW, look me up. So I recently went on vacation for 2 weeks to Idaho with my family, and the flight out and the flight back and just the in-between moments of vacation actually gave me some time to do something I've wanted to do since Christmas, which was read a novel by F. Paul Wilson called The Tomb. This was published by Tor Books. It was originally released in 1984. I think I have the reprint edition from 1998. This is a novel that introduced the world to Repairman Jack, which is Wilson's kind of shadowy hero who repairs situations rather than appliances. It reads like a kind of like a potboiler detective novel, with the pressure steadily increasing as Jack investigates the case of a missing British woman, and slowly uncovers an ancient vendetta that he may be powerless to stop. It has some supernatural aspects to it, but it has which sometimes kind of bothers me when it's in a real-world kind of setting. But at the same time, when it's done well, I like it. And it's done well in this book because Jack is dealing with it as a rational person would deal with it. He's trying to focus on the facts. He tries to come to terms with what the rules of the supernatural are. And then he deals with them. He doesn't allow himself to kind of get blown away by the mysticism. He's very a very down-to-earth, very kind of gritty kind of hero. It's a fast and easy read, which is good because I don't have an awful lot of time to read as a geek dad. It was really great for someone like me who grew up on the spy and superhero genres. Jack's a really great character, and to me, he seemed kind of like a modern-day Indiana Jones, but one who's never has to leave the larger New York metropolitan area for adventure. And as a guy who grew up in New Jersey, I mean, I had to appreciate all the scenes that took place on like the Turnpike, North Jersey, South Jersey. It was just that little extra something for me. As a metropolitan New York kind of guy, that made it a fun book. I don't know if other people would get as much out of it as I did, but New Jersey doesn't really get that much play in novels, and this may be the first genre novel that I've ever read that actually incorporates New Jersey. Someone else that he reminds me of is Dirk Pitt from Clive Cussler's various Numa books, only more of like a capitalist Dirk Pitt, one who is not working for a government agency, but rather is working for himself. Now, this character, Repairman Jack, lives on the fringe of society as a sort of, I guess you could describe him as a libertarian Batman, albeit a low-tech libertarian Batman. He's focused on putting right personal injustices rather than bad... He focuses, and you knew there was going to be a screw up in this podcast, guys. You just knew it. So there you go. There you have it. Savor the screw up. But anyway, as I was saying, he's not, he's like Batman in that he's trying to put right what went wrong, and he's trying to bring people to justice. But it's much more of, he's not dealing with supervillains so much as he's dealing with, more mundane threats, although in this particular novel, he takes a veer into the supernatural. But also, the big difference between him and, say, Batman, the more iconic character, would be that he's not about turning people into the authorities or having kind of like this symbiotic relationship with the cops. When Jack repairs something, it's repaired. And that basically amounts to kind of almost like a personal contract between him and the people that he is coming into blows with. I don't think contract is actually the right word, but he has sort of a mathematical process when he's coming to terms with vengeance. And I don't know. It's definitely different from, I think, anything else I've read in terms of the checks and balances. He's very much written from a libertarian standpoint, which, if none of you know what that means, basically what he's saying is, he's not initiating force against people. He is not going out and beating up the crap out of people. He is not actively trying to infringe on other people's rights. But when those bad people do that to others, and when the law just isn't capable of bringing about justice, people turn to Repairman Jack. Now the whole libertarian angle thing, isn't overly played. He refuses to pay taxes or pay homage to the U.S. government or any country. because it's more homage. But anyway, but you know, he has reasons for living on the fringes of society. It's just less of a manifesto and more of just part of what his character is. And when you read the backstory as it's presented in this book, it all makes sense. Some libertarian stuff that you'll read, and for those of you who don't know, I do consider myself to be a fairly libertarian-minded kind of guy, some of it just kind of hits you over the head with it, with the whole philosophy. This book is not like that. Jack lives on the fringe, but he's got reasons for living on the fringe, and it all just really works very well. So overall, I really enjoyed this book. I enjoy detective novels, and they've really grown on me over the last couple of years as I've read more of them in the course of my commute listening to audiobooks. The adventure here is pretty straightforward. I mean, it's not there's a couple of twists along the way, but you know, that doesn't bother me that it's not hideously overly complex. It's really more of a kind of a pulpy kind of book, and it worked well for me. I mean, I really enjoyed it. It's not you know, only certain books do I actually just tear through religiously and suddenly find myself reading it at any given moment, you know, like when I'm in the bathroom or when I've got a few moments while I'm waiting for my wife or something like that. And this was one of those books. This is one of those books that I picked up and I really didn't want to put down. So, well, it does have its flaws. You know, it could have had a little bit more complexity. You know, it's maybe a little bit. Occasionally, it relies a little bit too much on the action-adventure kind of cliches, particularly when Jack goes to kind of wage war on his enemy. But, you know, I still really liked it. I'm looking forward to reading the other Repairman Jack novels. And my overall rating, I'll give it an 8 out of 10. Masters and Minions, Maze of the Minotaur by Behemoth Press is part 2 of the Horde series, which is a collection of monster books that are compatible with D20 Dungeons & Dragons, and take a look at some of the iconic characters, or rather the iconic monsters from within the Dungeons & Dragons pantheon. It provides a comprehensive sort of ecology of the monster look at the individual creatures. I reviewed the first book, A Swarm of Sturges, for Nuketown, and found it to be a fun, if a bit unbalanced, take on the Sturge. And by unbalanced, I'm talking more about the approach than the game design. Some aspects of the Sturge, like its life cycle, were played straight, while others, like Sturge riding pixies known as Ashmiklin, and I apologize in advance if I butchered that, were just a little too munchkin-esque for my tastes. Maze of the Minotaur is a more consistent book, but its usefulness depends on what you think of the book's take on Minotaurs. It creates an entire Minotaur society that builds on the defining aspects of the creatures in mythology, namely their maze-like lairs. A detailed ecology is given that explains how these lairs arise in the wild. To that end, it discusses the classical Minotaur, as well as a half-dozen support monsters. Now, in this book, the Minotaur ends up being like the typical male of the Pride, which is the organizational unit that they use for Minotaurs in the book, obviously based on lions. The Minotrice is the typical female Minotaur. The Maze Mage is sort of a specialist Minotaur that offers druidic spells and basically allows the creatures to confound those who invade their lair. There's the Tauron, which is a near-mindless cattle-like creature that can carve out mazes using magical tunneling abilities, and which are kind of looked on by the other members of the Pride as, I guess, useful little brothers and sisters, if somewhat stupid. You know, they have a soft place in their heart for them, but, you know, when it comes right down to it, they're nearly just animals. And then finally, there is the Bull Lord, which is a fearsome advanced minotaur that rules over everyone. This monster is also available as a prestige class in the book, which basically breaks out the monster into class levels. The book includes several NPCs, sample NPCs, encounter write-ups, and a sample lair, and a detailed appendix that stats out the sample monsters. Now, these aren't actual stat blocks. This is more along the lines of the sort of approach to statting out NPCs that we used to see in the first edition modules, where you have a big table and it puts down what all of the important numbers are for a given creature. it actually works pretty well. You know, I haven't seen one of those tables in a long time, but and I didn't think it would work well with a D20 type product, just because there are so many freaking stats for, you know, the D20 stuff. But it actually works for this. Now, I should say, I keep mentioning D20 in this review, and it's kind of hard to get around that. This isn't technically a D20 book. It's an SRD book. And I believe they did that specifically because they needed to be able to have class advancement and stuff like that. And as a result, they didn't want to release it under the standard D20 license. However, that having been said, it is compatible with D&D 3.0 and 3.5. If you're familiar with those rule systems, you'll be familiar with this book. Now, I've got to admit that as I was reading through this book, you know, I got to thinking that, you know, the Minotaur, specifically the ecology of the Minotaur, isn't something I've really given much thought to. They always just sort of existed. I mean, even in Kryn, even when I was playing Dragonlance, which has Minotaurs, I didn't really give much thought to where the occasional odd Minotaur came from. Yes, they came from a continent across the ocean, and yes, they had, like, this code of honor, but, you know, that was pretty much it. I didn't give all that much thought to Minotaur society. And, you know, as I'm reading through this book, which provides a comprehensive ecology of the creatures, I couldn't help but kind of struggle with the nature of them. I mean, the basic idea is that these are man-killing humanoid hybrids. Well, when it comes right down to it, I mean, really, they're just glorified cows. I mean, that's not something you really think about when you're contemplating the lone Minotaur in a dungeon, because it's just a horror that's going to destroy your party. But, you know, as part of a larger ecology, I just can't help but wonder why these normally, you know, pacifistic plant-chomping bovine creatures suddenly developed a taste for human flesh. And as a result, you know, it was difficult for me, and I admit that this is my own hang-up, to kind of reconcile a cow with, you know, the lion pride metaphor that the authors chose for this source book. And again, I don't think it's necessarily a fault of the book so much as it is me just sitting there going, huh, I never really gave Minotaurs much thought. You know what? As a monster, they really don't make all that much sense. But anyway, as I say, this is admittedly my hang-up. The book does a decent job of tackling its subject matter, and it does provide a cohesive ecology that makes sense from a fantastical point of view. I don't think I would use it in my campaign, simply because of the contradictions I had mentioned, and honestly, I've never really been that fixated on Minotaurs. People who don't share my hang-up should check it out. It certainly makes sense. It certainly makes a cohesive sense from an ecological standpoint of why these creatures would exist the way they do. And it also makes it really easy to run a shake-and-bake Minotaur society. If you would want to have Minotaurs somewhere in your world, this is a book you could easily pick up and run with it. So, having said that, my overall rating for this book would be a 7 out of 10. If you are into Minotaurs, you know, you might want to up it to around an 8 out of 10. It's a decent book. It's a good source book. It's just not my particular cup of tea. Well, folks, that's about it for this edition of Radioactive, which is kind of disappointing because the caffeine just kicked in. As you may have noticed, I really picked up during the podcast, but that's what you do when you pick up 32 ounces of Mountain Dew. Woohoo! I'll be crashing any time now. Coming up on Radioactive in number 11, can you believe we actually hit number 11? I can't. It's really kind of astounding, but I digress. I'm going to dedicate most of the podcast to a review of Midnight Syndicate's The 13th Hour, which is a horror role-playing game soundtrack, which is compatible with Call of Cthulhu. More on that later. I'm also looking to do a review of the Battlestar Galactica Season 1 soundtrack, which I just received a copy of. I've been listening to, really enjoyed it. Just need to sit down and figure out which tracks I want to use in the podcast. I'm also looking to do more role-playing game reviews. I've got a whole bunch of source books sitting on my shelf, and I just need to sit down and figure out, you know, again, what the hell am I going to review? I'm always looking for feedback on both the podcast and the website. If you have comments, you can send them to nuketown@gmail.com. Audio comments are always welcome. You can also reach me via Skype at just the username Nuketown. And finally, I just wanted to note that the Atomic Swindlers sci-fi contest is still running. Details on that can be found on Radioactive number 8 show notes, which I will be including a link to from this particular podcast. So until next time, talk to you later.